What do you think, John? If you're amenable, we'll just go ahead and bring in Murtaza. And
Looking forward to it.
And we'll talk about it. Okay, here we go. Without further ado, joining us for this segment is Murtaza Hussain. He's the National Security and Foreign Affairs Correspondent at DropSite News, and he's a very well-followed and well-informed fellow, and it's a pleasure to have you joining us.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks, John. Great to be on with you.
Welcome.
So, obviously, the media is pouring through, and journalists are pouring through the 3 million or so documents that have been released, some in highly redacted, some in somewhat redacted form, as a result of the Epstein data dump. There's about 3 million more that we haven't seen, and we don't know if we're ever going to get to see. There's a lot of questions about this. Couple stories related to the Epstein story that just sort of broke overnight. Oddly, Epstein was, we knew he was an art collector, and we know that he was monetizing the collectible art market, but inexplicably, he apparently got the UAE, someone from the UAE sent him cloth pieces from the Kaaba, which is, of course, the shrine in Mecca in Saudi Arabia.
Insane. Insane. I can't believe, I couldn't believe it when I read it.
Yeah, I mean, what's up with that?
What's up with that?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, thanks for having me on to discuss this subject, because, you know, you would think that there'd be a greater appetite to talk about some of these disclosures, but it's actually been relatively muted, I would say, in the last few years when we started getting some information, granular detailed information about Epstein's activities. So, you know, for context, myself and my colleagues at DropSite News have been doing a series of stories based on Epstein's intelligence activities. And we've been doing that for maybe about 6-7 months now. And those stories were based not primarily on government disclosures, but on two sets of hacked emails that were released separately and just happened to contain Epstein's correspondence. One was with a former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who was known to be an Epstein associate, but he had several thousands of emails with Epstein, which were in his hacked inbox, which posted on a site called the Distributed Denial of Secrets. And then there's another actual inbox, which was actually Epstein himself, partially his Yahoo inbox, which we had, and Bloomberg had a similar inbox from him as well, too. So we did about maybe almost a dozen stories based on those emails, which were quite limited, really. They were only, you know, several thousand messages, but we got tremendous information out there about his ties with global leaders, about his intelligence connections, about his financial interests, many, many different things about his life. And, you know, that was a pretty limited, you know, as I said, set of data. So this new dump, 3 million files, is so tremendous. It's really like a lot to go through. So when people ask me what are my takeaways and so forth, you know, I would say I don't exactly know yet, because, you know, many people are jumping to many quick conclusions about it, both to dismiss it all, which I find more problematic, or even to make a firm conclusion. But I think that, you know, it was so laborious and took so much time for us to figure out what was going on in that smaller set that I think it's going to take us quite a lot of time to get digestible information out of this. But that said, you know, there are some things in there which were, you know, low-hanging fruit, you could say. They were very obvious, egregious, kind of shocking episodes, interactions he had with individuals, things related to, you know, people's, you know, if not involvement, but at least, you know, sharing like sexual encounters with Epstein, or, you know, photos and things like that, which do relate to his sex crimes potentially. That's all in there. And, you know, John, you mentioned the his interactions with the Emiratis and Saudis and Qataris and so forth. He had very intimate interactions with them, actually. And this was the basis of the story that the DropSite did in mid-January about his ties with a gentleman named Sultan Sulaim, who's one of the most powerful people in the UAE. And he's the chief of this company called Dubai Ports World, which owns and operates ports all over the world. And Epstein had a very close relationship with him. You can read more detail of the story, but I was actually reading more emails where in the new dump between him and Sulaim, they would routinely share kind of like sophomoric, you know, vulgar emails in between, you know, talking about arranging meetings with powerful people and business and so forth. They're very close. And so, you know, when you mentioned that he would send this religious relics by these Emiratis and Saudis and so forth, I think it was reflective of the tremendous importance and weight that they put on their relationship with Epstein. They viewed him as somebody who was integral to their political interests in the United States and beyond that as well, too, in Europe and Russia and elsewhere, and someone who they really had intimate, close, you know, fondness for and liking off. And, you know, I'll say it's very funny. You know, they sent him the cloth of the Kaaba. This was many, many years after he'd already become notorious as a sex pedophile. So it was like they didn't even care. And if you look at other emails with him and that the woman who sent it, who arranged the shipment to him.
Do we know where these relics are now, by the way?
That I don't know, but according to the email, it was sent to his island, like the island where, you know, the sex island and so forth. So it was like layers upon layers of, kind of irony and kind of grotesqueness. But, you know, I think the issue is that at this strata socioeconomically and politically of people's power, the ethnic, religious, racial sort of divisions, which are so pronounced maybe at the general public's level, they almost kind of dissipate. They all view themselves sort of on the same team or part of the same club. And I think that's also one of the subtexts of this rare glimpse into elite activities and communications afforded by these emails.
Murtaza, one of the weasel words in journalism is ties. And I'm not accusing you of weaselry, but, you know, it's like so-and-so has ties. Because that can mean anything, right? Like someone sends an email to someone one time, that's a tie. When you say that Epstein, let's say, had ties with, for example, the Emiratis, I mean, you got into it a little bit, but I mean, like, kind of like, how would this, what degree of intimacy or coziness would you, like, on a scale from 1 to 10, at elite levels, would you put this at?
Yeah, and you know, people, this is part of one of the problems with the dump, is that people are going through the email and the emails, and they're seeing, like, you know, one or two emails that he had with some individual at some point, and positing that that means that that individual must have been involved in his sex crimes or knowledgeable about them and so forth, where that's not necessarily the case. You know, there are a lot of people whose names show up in there once or twice just because they happen to be in the same circles, and even meeting with them actually is not necessarily indicative of a wrongdoing per se. So, you know, but I think in this case, it's interesting. This part of what we talked about in our story is that there was a very long-term, years-long relationship, you know, almost like regular daily contact, if not weekly and so forth.
Really?
And also, very crucially, involvement in meetings, business deals, investments together, introductions to powerful people as well, too, for purposes of making business with them and making deals with them. So that was all taking place. And I think with Epstein, in the case of the Emiratis, you know, Epstein was very open about his interest with others of kind of laying the groundwork for what would later become the Abraham Accords. And the Abraham Accords was signed in 2020, a year after Epstein died. But he would actually set up meetings between Emirati and Israeli elites for the purpose of building connections with them that they could use to make business, but also could be used for the groundwork of later political reconciliation, which actually did come to pass shortly after Epstein passed away. And, you know, in the case of him and Soleim, it's very interesting. There was a Rolling Stone article some years ago that quoted Epstein kind of boasting about the fact that he basically was so close with the owner of a port in East Africa, the port of Berbera, which is now in a territory called Somaliland, and that he said he basically owned the port because of his relationship with this individual. And no one really knew what he was talking about at that time. It sounded like an empty boast and excessive sort of comment. But I think the emails do show that he did have an extremely close relationship with Soleim. He wasn't lying about that. And whether that meant he owned the port and that's how he got rich off it, maybe that we don't really can't say from the country. The emails, Murtaza, there's certainly some that's about it. Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. What would somebody like Soleiman get from a relationship like this? If you're already rich and you're already connected and you know that Jeffrey Epstein is a convicted pedophile, why even cultivate a relationship like this? Is there any indication in these documents what was the quid pro quo, what he got out of it?
Well, you know, it's so the funny thing is we have so many of their emails in this case going back many, many years that we can actually reconstruct at least some of the relationship and the motivations behind it. But, you know, the emails actually start, and then that's it is when they first met, but the correspondence becomes very extensive around 2006. And in 2006, there was an event which happened, which many people don't remember today, but it was the failed purchase of some ports in the United States by Dubai Port World. Yeah. So at that time, it was the height of the Iraq War. You know, 9/11 just happened. There was a lot of suspicion of the idea that a Middle Eastern Arab or Muslim country would own critical infrastructure in the United States. And it generated this huge backlash. And then the deal was ultimately reneged upon. So, you know, for the UAE, that was a very eye-opening sort of event, because they thought that they had already ingratiated themselves with American elites, and they couldn't believe that this happened, and they were sort of pushed back upon. And in their view, they need to redouble their sort of information and influence buying in the United States to make sure that never happened again, and that they could do whatever they want in the United States. They basically saw the U.S. as like an open market that they want to participate in and buy whatever they want. And to do that, they needed to build ties with American elites who could advocate for them. And there was also perception, which I think is still to this day, that the pro-Israel American elites are a very, very, fertile ground to buy and seed influence in the United States. So Epstein was seen as somebody like this. He was like a pro-Israel American elite who, if you develop ties with, he could make sure that your relationship or your reputation in the U.S. is good, your relationship with U.S. policymakers and the press is good. And Soleim sort of built his relationship with Epstein around that time. They started visiting him, going to the island and so forth, and being in regular contact with him, drawing upon his advice for many, many different things. And over the course of a decade, and our story reconstructs this, it goes all the way to his death in 2019, just a few months before he was arrested and died, actually, Epstein and Soleim had become very intimate. And he relied upon Epstein to help sort of position Dubai and position the UAE in a PR sense in the U.S. But I think at that point, they also became very good friends. They had shared economic interests and they had shared geopolitical interests in the region, too.
Murtaza, two-part question. Why wasn't the pedophilia conviction and the previous jail term toxic to these people? And could you possibly go to the island and not know the sordid occurrences that were happening?
Right.
Yeah, well, that's a really amazing question. I think we all have that question looking at these correspondence, because it's not even that people are different. In some of these emails, some of the messages and so forth, people are congratulating him on his skills with the quote-unquote the ladies. And this is years after he was well-known for the pedophilia and sex trafficking and so forth. It was almost treated as a subject of levity and irony and so forth that he was engaged in this. In his birthday book, if you look at some of the pages, people have written messages and drawn pictures. They're congratulating him on being such a good pedophile. That's actually what's going on in this. And so
they don't only not care, they think it's funny.
They think it's funny.
They want to
continue visiting the island. They're still talking about their own sexual encounters in the emails with Epstein, asking for advice and so forth. So I think that basically what is indicative of is this was a class of people who had enjoyed tremendous impunity. And to be honest, they still enjoy impunity because nothing has really happened per se to for the most part, a few people here and there, but for a vast majority of them, nothing's really happened. So they viewed it as sort of something that they were above laws and above common morality and so forth. So the whole idea this is wrong or they should be worried about it never seemed to emerge to them as it would so obviously to us.
And they didn't think, oh, someday this could bite me in the ass.
Right.
Well, this is also the thing which I wonder because, a lot of these emails, this actually takes place, these communications, over a very long stretch of time during which the technological environment has changed in that time as well, too. There wasn't Signal chat or WhatsApp back in 2006 or even 2011 and so forth necessarily. So they were treating email the way we might treat text messages today. So they were communicating a lot there. And I think the whole understanding that this is something which could come out, it's more like a record of the communications, maybe was not as imprinted upon everyone's mind at that time. But that said, it did continue up to 2019, which is way beyond that point. So maybe it's also something that people got in the habit. And maybe these communications, where they exist today, they would not take place in email. They'd take place in a format which is more ephemeral or more easy to conceal, at least.
Murtaza, we're going to talk a little bit later on after after we lose you later in the show about the latest from Gaza, as you heard. How do you and this is purely speculative, but how do you think Epstein's role as a connector in sort of the Malcolm Gladwell sort of vein, how would that have played out if he hadn't gone to prison and
it's a good question.
Committed suicide given the Gaza war?
Yeah, I think that he was somebody who was sort of this individual who bridged the world between the U.S., the Gulf Arab countries, and the Israelis. And there are other people like this who you can perceptibly see play a similar role, like the Jared Kushners and the even Steve Witkoff of the world, and many, many other individuals like that who are less prominent, who are sort of this Abraham Accordists. And by Abraham Accordists, I mean they're people who were sort of, they're kind of the interstitial individuals between who kind of made these ties possible. So I think he would probably be seen as like a mediator in some sense, informally. I think he would help navigate the PR concerns of these countries globally. He would help try to build business connections between elites in these countries that would thereafter foster perhaps a political agreement. And I think this is something which is extremely important subtext to the Epstein story is that, you know, he wasn't a public official, obviously. He wasn't associated with any individual. People often ask after reading our stories about his Israel ties, was he a Mossad agent? Absolutely not. I don't think that was any the way they describe his relationship. He was somebody who was kind of a product of the post-Cold War world where institutions were sort of downgraded in favor of, powerful transnational individuals and networks of people. Yeah, and what he was doing was actually more important than what the states were doing in a way. And he actually opened the door for the states to make moves later on. So if he was alive today, I would imagine he would be start pitching, investment opportunities in Gaza, or, pushing business deals between Saudis and Israelis or Qataris and Israelis as a means of greasing the wheels for later diplomatic encounters. So, yeah, I think he'd be very active at this time had he not met his unfortunate end in some way in prison.
Murtaza, we have a question from one of our listeners, but I want to add to it. He says, do you know if the Epstein files are a topic of media coverage and public interest in the Gulf countries or in the Middle East more broadly? And the reason why I want to highlight that question is I was just in Kuwait a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to go back, I think, around the first of April, but not just Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE, Oman. And the people that I'm going to speak to specifically told me to arrive smart about the Epstein files because that's what people wanted to talk to me about. Are you getting that kind of feedback from the Gulf countries? Are they as interested in this issue as we are?
You know, it's interesting. I've done interviews with the Egyptian television and Lebanese television and so forth. And Al Jazeera, obviously, which is based in Qatar, also reached out to talk about it. But it's been sort of interesting because, every country in the region, they kind of view this in terms of their own elite interests and their relationships with one another as well, too. So, I think that it's kind of funny. Like, this is completely false, but I think that they often view a story which comes out, if it mentions an Emirati, for instance, they assume the Qataris seeded it somehow, or the Saudis did it.
Sure.
Yeah, or vice versa. The Qataris have the story, then they think the Emiratis did it. So, and that's just not how things work in the U.S. necessarily. Sometimes it does, I guess, but generally speaking, there is more of a fluidity oftentimes. And it just happens to be a coincidence that maybe one country and others mentioned basically who comes up in the emails. But, I think that's kind of the subtext of a lot of it. So I think that the more they talk about it, it's in a context that they would like to use it as a political weapon or somehow, or like a tool in the current political standoffs that have taken place. So I think that's kind of the predominant view I've had of it. And of course, it could change as time goes on, but that's my impression. And whereas some of the countries which are more outside the Gulf have been interested to talk about more just for subject general interest.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, state media doesn't have the kind of lock hold on people's information flow that they used to do. But in the Gulf states, is this story getting much sort of official mainstream coverage, or is it something people have to get on their own from the internet?
I haven't seen much, and there may be some stories here and there. But I was checking, Emirati media, and so I wasn't expecting to show up there. But I didn't see very much there. Al Jazeera has covered it in English, and there may be some Arabic as well, too. They've covered it, but, they're a bit different because they do have covered things globally and they're sort of dispersed and so forth. So it's somewhat less locked down in some ways, but I have not seen a tremendous amount of coverage. And normally, for the magnitude of the stories, you'd expect to see, most importantly, television hits with people regularly to talk about it. That's been relatively limited, muted. And it's not to say they're not interested in it and haven't covered it at all, but I don't think it's being framed yet, at least primarily as a Gulf story. But it's interesting, John, that you mentioned that they wanted to talk about that specifically when you go there, because that may change in the near future.
Thank you so much, Murtaza Hussein, for joining us. Hope you'll come back. He's the National Security and Foreign Affairs Correspondent at DropSite News, and I would say an expert on the Epstein files. So
DropSiteNews.com. If you haven't been, check it out. I'm there every day.
Go check it out. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Murtaza.
Have a great day.
Thank you. Outstanding. You know, good. Drop Site News, this is what investigative journalism is supposed to be, right? This is what the Post, the Times, the Journal, the LA Times, what they used to do.